Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Congressman Brett Guthrie, U.S. Representative from Kentucky's 2nd District. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Good morning. Hey, Jay.
Good morning.
How is everybody this morning? Cool and frosty?
It is a little cool out this morning, but
but it's not snowing.
That's a plus. We were in Lexington yesterday and day before, and it snowed up there.
So, did it really? On the ground?
It got a little bit on the grass, which is more than I ever want to see. So
it just didn't last very long.
That's
thankfully.
Right. Yep.
So.
You know, we're recording this just a little before Christmas, which show won't actually air until January.
So it could be snowing today. We just don't know it.
It could be snowing. It could be a lot colder when folks are actually listening to this than it is right now. It's a little brisk this morning, but not terrible. Right. I think most of us expect, especially around Christmas time, we have a little anticipation of somewhat cool weather and a little bit of snow.
Are you going to sing? Like you can sing it for us.
I probably should not do that.
Okay.
Folks that have heard me sing probably should have been in bed at that hour of the night.
So they wouldn't be dreaming. It'd be a nightmare of a white Christmas.
That's exactly right. But got a guest with us today, Congressman Brett Guthrie. Good morning, sir.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you on the show. This
Absolutely.
Is kind of a new thing for us, having not only elected officials, but especially our federally elected officials.
Well, thanks for having me. You had Representative Comer on yet?
We have not. We need to do that as
He's
well.
He's busy. So.
Yeah, you're the very first one.
Okay.
And it has taken us a while to get this worked out. We've been working on this for probably close to a year.
Well, we've been busy.
So, yeah,
if you haven't
absolutely.
Noticed the last few, the times that they schedule breaks into our schedule, for the last 10 weeks we haven't had any. We've been trying to figure out how to put a speaker in office and set us behind on everything else, which I know we're going to talk some about the farm bill today.
Sure.
And we can get into all of that, but that's really set us back.
You know, and I would say, jumping forward, that was probably one of the biggest setbacks to getting that done. I guess it was.
Oh, absolutely. It all happened about the time we should have been doing the farm bill.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So. But for the folks that don't know you, might not have heard anything about you before, why don't you give just a brief introduction about yourself, how you came to the area, and what brought you to this position?
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on this morning. And I know it just bleeds into some of far western Kentucky and redistricting. I picked up more of West Kentucky in redistricting, picking up the rest of Ohio. I've had part of Ohio before, McLean, Muhlenberg, and so I've always had Davis and Hancock, and so we're kind of moving in that direction, so it's great to be here. So my kind of story, I don't tell a lot of people this, but I was actually born in Alabama, so I guess everybody That's listening right. will hear that, and grew up in the Muscle Shoals area and the music that people know Muscle Shoals for, and I grew up with all that going on. I was a kid when one of my good friends' dad was one of the Swampers, so people always wonder what that line is. Muscle Shoals has got the Swampers.
They've
been known to pick a song
yeah.
or two. There are four of them, and David Hood, the bass player's son, Patterson Hood, is in a band called the Drive-By Truckers, and I grew up together, and as a matter of fact, our mothers grew up together, so that's kind of town that I'm from.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't in the middle of it. I was too little, but I certainly knew what was all going on at the time. And, you know, the Rolling Stones and all these other people came to Muscle Shoals, Alabama to record.
Wow.
My dad worked for Ford, and so it gets to where our story is. My dad made castings worked in a casting plant for Ford Motor Company. Henry Ford wanted to buy what is now TVA. And create a River Rouge plant south where he made all the stuff came in on the Tennessee River and the cars went out the door. He didn't quite pull that off. TVA became TVA instead of Ford.
Right.
But they built the foundry and my dad worked there and then he worked his way up into management. And then Ford decided to outsource die castings, is what he made, manifolds, pistons, things like that. And my dad said, well, Ford wants to buy them from somebody. I don't know how to make them. Then maybe I'll make them for him. And he had a cousin in Bowling Green. I was in high school at the time. Just graduated from high school, actually moved. And at that time, I thought I was going to be a career military person.
Right.
So I went to the U.S. Military Academy. Go Army, be Navy at West Point. We had another big win. I know this is in mid-January, but this is still a week after the Army-Navy game. So I'm excited, still excited about it. And thought I was going to do a career in the military. The Berlin Wall came down. People can't really understand – you know, my children, I try to describe to them what the world was like right. at the time. And maybe it's a little more stable, quite honest, if you looked at it with two big, powerful armies staring at each other, right. knowing if one crossed the line, it was going to cause a problem. Mm-hmm. But then when the wall came down, my dad had started a business, so I decided to go into business with him. But thought maybe there's a way I can serve. I always wanted to serve. I kind of got called to go to West Point by Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. I'm 59, so I was born in 1964, so I'm 16 in 1980 and when Reagan came into the scene. And so ended up working in adult education because we needed tool and die. It was the same mm-hmm. thing you hear today. There are not mm-hmm. enough skilled trades.
Right.
Started sending people in our factory that my dad started in Bowling Green to a tool and die school. And I'll never forget, I always tell the story that Curtis is Chrysler. He had bought one of the big Dodge Ram, pickup trucks, and he showed up one day. He had been going to night school to be a tool and die maker. Mm-hmm. And he went from an old jalopy, I don't know how I had to describe it, to this brand new, he probably shouldn't have first paycheck gone and bought a truck that expensive, but he did. And everybody said, how in the world did Curtis afford that? And he was a tool and die maker. Yeah. I said, yeah, he just doubled his income and almost tripled it, actually, and because of what he did. He yeah. made himself valuable. And so an opportunity to run for the state Senate. I enjoyed working in adult ed. I wanted to be part of education. But when I first got, I had Logan and Warren counties. Mm-hmm. I was on the ag committee in Frankfort, and somebody mm-hmm. said, what in the world do you know about agriculture? I said, I know the most important thing. It's the largest business in my district. You think of everything that's in Warren County. Now, Logan is a massive farm. You know, it's got mm-hmm. the flat land, that good flat land.
Yep.
Warren, but it was the agriculture is the biggest business in at that time in Warren and Logan counties, and so got involved in agriculture kind of that way. I come from grandparents who grew up, you know, subsistence farmers, kind of like the Deep South. That's what you did. You grew your own food and maybe a little cotton to try to get some cash, but that they weren't farmers like we know today.
Right.
They were just taking care of themselves. But they farmed, and so that's kind of a heritage of mine and something I've appreciated. When my predecessor, Ron Lewis, decided to retire, an opportunity to run for Congress, as you know, I've always been interested in military, foreign affairs. You know, we don't really do that in Frankfort. You do a lot of very important things in Frankfort. That's where mm-hmm. most education policy is done, economic development is done. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not dismissing that. It's just different. And so I decided to do that. And the budget, the federal budget that we're still wrestling with. But that's where I am. So I've went to Washington. I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee, which I think is important. This mm-hmm. area that goes as you go west because of coal, trying to figure out what we're going to do with the energy workers in the coal fields. And so I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee. I'm chairman of the Healthcare Subcommittee. Talking about getting a handle on the budget. Most of our big budget items, big ticket items in the budget are healthcare.
Yep.
That's it. And so trying to get control of the rising cost of healthcare is what I focus on almost every day. And why, where people can say I have access, they can have the benefits they've been promised. I always say, particularly Medicare, we want people to have the benefits they've been promised at the price that grandchildren can afford to pay. And that's what we're trying to, now that I have grandchildren, I get it.
Sure.
I always say, I heard somebody say one time, you can't pit grandparents against grandchildren. Because they have a common enemy. So think about that. When I heard that, I wasn't a grandparent. I said, wait a minute, we're not the common enemy. No, we love our children. But anyway, but you're right, that is something that we have to make sure as I'm into the baby boom, born in 1964 and 59. Mm-hmm. So in 6 years, every baby boomer is going to be retired, mm-hmm. be 65 or older, whether they're retired or not, I guess. And it really puts a demographic strain on the system.
Yep, sure. Well, that's interesting, and you know, you talked about being on that energy committee and talk about something that's very important to farmers around here is the ethanol. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of give us a little bit of an update maybe on where things stand right now as far as, you know, I had heard a news story about, you know, trying to get more ethanol into the gas mm-hmm. and that type of thing.
Well, we're trying to figure it all out. Of course, the administration, the Biden administration wants to get rid of all fuel like that. So, I mean, ethanol is more environmentally friendly and it's renewable mm-hmm. fuel standard, as they call RFS with ethanol mm-hmm. in. But currently what we're fighting is the Biden administration wants to mandate that 2/3 of every car in America is electric. And if you, by 2032, that's 9 years. Now, I just said my family's in the automotive supply business. It takes about 5 to 7 years to make a new car model, but from mm-hmm. concept to production. And so the idea that we're going to make, if we make 15 million cars a year in America, we're going to make 10 million electric cars that people want to buy, have 10 million people a year that want to buy them, is just a fallacy. But that's what's driving policy in D.C. mm-hmm. because the EPA is demanding it. Right. And so we're trying to fight that. And then the other thing is the question, do you go from 10 to 15% ethanol and fuel? You know, that's something we're still debating. There are a lot of Republicans, quite honestly, that are I think we need to the more sustainable renewable fuels is better. Mm-hmm. So I understand that we have some Republicans, quite honestly, say, well, just let the market work and stay out of the way. But it's important to have those renewable fuel standards, and mm-hmm. I've been supportive of them.
Yep.
You know, I guess I've got a question to go along with that. When we think about that many electric vehicles on the mm-hmm. road, and certainly I feel like they have their place. There's people that you know, that fits their vehicle needs.
Right.
It's not me, but I know there's some people that
right.
it probably does. When I think about our aging electrical grid and how we would be able to produce, you know, that much raw
that
electricity
much
and then gild it down to the point that it can go into a car, can we make that transition quick? Much less produce the vehicles.
We absolutely can't. And the thing is, I'm for somebody the other day said, I put some solar in. I apologize for putting solar in my whatever. He was telling me about that. And I said, I'm all for solar if it works for you.
Yep,
I'm not for it if it doesn't work for you. You can't sustain the current demand with solar and wind. You just can't. If you had, I don't know how many gigawatts you need of power, but if you had triple the level in solar and wind, when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, you don't have electricity. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have other sources of power. That's only supplemental. But think about it. So they're trying to get rid of not only the aging grid and the grid needs to be updated, but they're trying to restrict the grid. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they're wanting to bring 10 million cars a year. That's not 10 million cars. That's 10 million cars a year moving forward. And I had Secretary Granholm, so the energy grant, she was the governor of Michigan in the 2000s, and I said to her, we had a chance to enter in a hearing, asked her questions. I said, so the EPA saying there's going to be 2/3 of all cars, that's what the rule is, has to be electric by 2032. And she, yeah. So I said, here's the problem. Y'all just dismiss when we say, well, there's not enough electric grid, mm-hmm. there's not enough charging stations, there's not enough capacity to move forward, there's not enough rare earth materials. They come from Africa, which a lot of them have serious humanitarian issues the way these are extracted mm-hmm. in these countries. And y'all just dismiss that because it's all the end result is the electric car, regardless of the cost. And people don't operate that way. Mm-hmm. And I said this, I said, you know who doesn't operate that way? The American consumer. They're only going to buy something that works for them, and you just can't mandate that. And that's what we're seeing. I say my family's in the business. The F-150 Lightning, it's a fantastic truck. It is absolutely a wonderful truck. I've driven it. But if you want to drive it to Destin, Florida, you're going to have to plan your stops. And that's the thing and if you're going to haul anything with it, it doesn't have the capacity for it. And we've seen it, Jennifer Granholm was going to prove that you could drive a car to Florida, I guess from D.C. to Florida, and got to North Carolina and had to stop because there weren't enough charging stations. The chairman of Ford, Jim Farley, was going to prove you could drive the F-150. I forget how far west he got. He left from Detroit. Yeah. But I think I don't even think he got to Nevada, but I think he was somewhere in that western world where you couldn't find charging station. He finally said, forget it. And what happened is that the F-150 was set up for the government charging stations that Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, mm-hmm. is putting everywhere with your tax dollars. Now, how many your tax dollars are going to gas pumps, but they're going into electric stations? And Jim Farley said, this just isn't working. It's complete failure. Mm-hmm. And he goes on. And so if you have an F-150 Lightning, Ford Motor Company sent you a adapter so you could charge your F-150 with a Tesla, which is private sector. Mm-hmm. So here's another problem with it. It's all this government funding. Which is, I mean, Pete Buttigieg, I know he thinks he's the smartest person in America. Even if he was the smartest person in America, he's not smart enough to put it exactly the spot everybody wants it to move forward. The reason gas stations are where the people want them to is because that's where the marketplace demanded them to be.
Economics.
That's where the marketplace, and you see them dry up, right? If a new highway moves around and you know, we were talking about Logan County, 6880 now goes around Auburn, there's an old gas station that's not there anymore. You know, it's still there, but people don't use it because it changed. And the market demand, you know, changes, and the government just can't do it. And that's the problem with it. They compare to China. because, you know, China's going almost all electric. But one, it's an authoritarian government. So if you think about, they keep saying that different people in the Republican Party are authoritarian. If I'm in the Biden EPA, I'm saying you must drive an electric car. Now, China can tell you that. You don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is they're also building the grid. They're building coal-fired power plants. So they're not doing it for environmental reasons. They're doing it to get off oil and gas because I think they want to invade Taiwan. Well, I know they want to invade Taiwan, and they don't have their own oil and gas. Mm-hmm. They have coal. China has coal, so they're saying we're going to move to a coal transportation economy and not a oil and gas because if they invade Taiwan, they know there'll probably be an oil embargo.
You know, coal's a whole different topic, especially here in the state of Kentucky. We've seen, you know, basically the kill-off, I'll say, of the coal industry in the past few years. There's still coal out there.
Still in the ground, isn't it?
One of the things that we've seen since the beginning of the coal industry in Kentucky is coal mining will work with the economy. Then it'll ease back. It'll slow back because it's not economically feasible to go after the remaining coal. Mm-hmm. And then a few years go by, the technology changes. It gets more affordable, so they go back in, they harvest more coal. Because we know coal's in the ground and because we know the technology is advancing, because these other countries around the globe are driving that technology, do we see any type of revamp or reestablishment of the coal industry in Kentucky in the next decade?
Well, I think so. You got to remember, these people are just anti-coal to be anti-coal. They just, for some reason, are just anti-coal. What I think if we could all sit down and say, you know, less carbon in the atmosphere is better. Making sure we have a cleaner environment obviously is better.
Low sulfur.
There is technology to take that out of the coal. You can do that now. You can actually take the carbon out the smokestack. There's some kind of adhesive that the carbon will attach to the smokestack. You peel the adhesive off and you throw it away. That's coming. That's coming. It's not, you know, massively available, but that technology is being developed. Mm-hmm. And so the coal's still in the ground, and so it's going to be an opportunity to do that. And so I do think, right, it's going to be there, and we're going to use it. Eventually it's going to come back around, but not with this group at the EPA because they're just anti-coal, just reflexively. Mm-hmm. Even if you step back and say, well, we can get more BTUs, we can burn it clean and have less carbon in the air, or similar to natural gas carbon in the air, not zero. Wind and solar, zero, but also some days you get zero electricity. Mm-hmm. And so there's a trade-off with it. Imagine if you can't run a hospital. If you can't, I mean, there is a benefit to having cheap energy prices, societal benefit. It's not a bad thing to have cheap energy, as the current EPA would think, as puts out. And so I do think that there's opportunities for that to come back. Absolutely.
Great. I think there's
I'm not predicting it's going to happen in the next year or two, but there's opportunities for
it. I'm going to write that down.
Maybe in the next decade.
I think so, because the technology is going to – well, if you look at it, when I was a kid in the 1970s, we were going to run out of oil and gas.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we knew it was there, but it was too expensive to get. Well, they figured out with vertical drilling horizontal drilling. Right. I'm trying to get my geometry right. I was not the best geometry person. But horizontal drilling and with fracking, that we can now get it out of the ground, and we have more gas. If you'd have told me when I was 15 years old, when I'm pushing my dad's Pinto to the local gas station to fill up and get it because he didn't want to wait in gas line. Like he said, well, that's the job of my son to do, go wait in gas line instead of me.
Yep.
I literally would push it because I wasn't old enough to drive once he drove it in line, that we were going to have more oil and gas than Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
It would just, you wouldn't imagine that, would you? But I think you're going to see that kind of innovation in coal and other types of energy. Because cheap energy drives the economy.
Absolutely.
And it makes people's lives better. Yep. And when you get in this whole environmental climate change, which, like I said, when you criticize them, they say you're anti-environment. And I'm absolutely not. But what it's an elitist group of people who fly on private jets and tell you that you need to drive an electric car. Mm-hmm. And that it's the hypocrisy of it. It's the elitism of it. And you're never going to solve – somebody said one time, I wish it was original to me, it wasn't. You're never going to solve the world's problems by asking people to do less. You're going to do it through technology and innovating and making it better.
Yeah. Well, we only continue to see the coal industry grow in other nations.
Well, like China.
Just as you mentioned with China.
Oh, yeah.
We know that technology is out there to make that more affordable product.
Germany is buying more coal. Mm-hmm. And they went green and realized they were – I think the energy prices in Germany were seven times other industrialized countries. Now, try to compete with that. in an economy. And now Germany's open and cold. They're now only three times as high, but it's still difficult to compete when your input costs are three times high as everywhere else.
And their next door neighbor, Poland, is one of the largest coal mining areas in Eastern Europe.
So. And it's only more expensive because government made it so. Right, it's not like they're in a bad spot in a bad location. You're right. They're right next to Poland. It used to be part of Germany as way before World War II throughout history, but it's all right there together. And so it's just purely the government's decision to make energy more expensive that has called energy poverty. You make people poorer. Because, I was in Chicago this week. I paid $3.30 for gas, and it was like $2.80 when I got down the road a little bit. And I'm thinking, I can't believe I just paid that. But it didn't – I bought it. But I know people that I know that actually make decisions on where they're going to go based on the price of gas. Mm-hmm. And so for people that a lot of people making the policy, they say, oh, this is just an inconvenience. But to some people, it's a way of life to have high energy prices. And and we can't dismiss those people. They're important too.
Absolutely.
And I know the elitists to go to climate change conferences talk about the poor. But people who live in the real world and see people that are poor realize what the effect it really has on them.
It reminds me of a bumper sticker I saw in Eastern Kentucky one time on the back of a good friend's truck. It said, "You think coal's ugly? Look at poverty."
Exactly.
Yeah. That's right. Well, Congressman Guthrie, what are some things, and we can kind of move into kind of some things on the farm bill, but what are some things that you're hearing that are going to be on the farm bill or in the farm bill that are going to be helpful to maybe some of our listeners that are listening?
Well, thanks for that. And we were hopefully going to have a farm. Well, it would have expired on September the 30th this year. Mm-hmm. It was extended for a year, so we're operating under the current farm bill, which I kind of, one, was kind of regretting that it was extended for a year because that means that everything works to a deadline in Washington. So if the deadline's a year from now, we only extended it for a year, but we could do it in February. Yeah. And maybe we will, but my guess is going to go to the extension. And the reason that happened is that it was supposed to happen in September, and that's when we got into the speaker's fight. Yep. And we can get into that if you want to move forward, as we move forward. But so that's what went to the farm bill. The issue with the farm, so the big issues for me is that make sure we have crop insurance. I'm one of the people have their bases reevaluated moving forward. That's what I've talked to the chairman and Glenn Thompson, G.T. Thompson, who's a friend of mine of the Ag Committee. And that's just the bottom line. For the farm section of the farm bill, it's got to have crop insurance for me because that's how people stay in business in a bad time. And we don't want everything to be one big farm. We like the idea of the diversity in the farm economy. And to have that, you have to have good crop insurance and stepped up bases. I've talked to some people in some apple orchard the other day. I went to visit and he talking about labor. We know that's important, but we can't really solve the labor problem. Now, some of it's administration just being hard on farm labor because they know that if they make it difficult for people to come legally to work on a farm, which farmers want to legally have people here to work, then they want to put pressure on Republicans to change the immigration policy, which is interesting. They're making it almost impossible to bring farm labor in a legal way, but just open the borders are wide open. And until we get the border under control, and that's what we're working on now, trying to force the president to get the border under control, which is hard to say. That imagine the president doesn't want to get the border under control, but he doesn't appear to because he's making no effort to do it. I don't think it's just ineptness. He's making no effort to do it. And so we need to get the border under control. So farm labor, I think the biggest thing to hear from farmers, crop insurance and farm labor.
Yep.
And that's what we have to focus on moving forward. The other big part of the farm bill, as you guys know, is the food stamps or SNAP program.
Right.
And the reason I think it's going to work to a deadline because we want work requirements for able-bodied people with food stamps. We put that in the debt limit bill. We want to strengthen that. We think people between 18 and 54, if you're married, but you could be married but not with children, if you're not a dependent child, not taking care of a dependent parent or adult, not with a drug problem. He said, if you're in rehabilitation, we'll let you have food stamps to get rehabilitated. So you take an able-bodied person without any dependence, without caring for an adult, without a substance use disorder, maybe they should work. I know, and we're fighting that. That's what we're fighting. So I think the big issues to do the farm bill will be that. Mm-hmm. We're actually coming up with a good policy for people to work. And that's going to be a fight with the left, and we know that's going to be. And then once we always get that figured out, there's something that always crops up at the end, whether it's Alabama versus Texas cotton farmers, or we've had that since I've been there. Big dairy versus little dairy. You know, Wisconsin has massive – people don't understand. You think of Wisconsin as Milwaukee, and you think of New York as New York City, but there's massive dairy farms in upstate New York and upstate obviously Wisconsin with cheese. And so those usually want different dairy policies that hurt the smaller dairy guys here in Kentucky, so we end up in that fight as well. Right. So we want to make sure that the farm bill is hopefully done on time next year in a way that gets crop insurance. Labor is in a different bill. Mm-hmm. And we need to work on that.
Yeah, I was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about this morning was the immigration situation and the H-2A program, those programs, and how the open borders really are affecting. How is that going to affect our H-2A program? I mean, we've got lots of people.
As you know, if you're a farmer and you're trying to legally use the H-2A program to get people here to work, one, it needs to be year-round because you need – farm, it's not just seasonal.
Right.
Dairy cows aren't seasonal, as you guys know. You know, H-2A works in tobacco because you come in, you know, it's seasonal. And so the problem is you got to go through this Labor Department approval, and they make it almost impossible. They make it even harder for this H-2A program to work, which is kind of the hypocrisy of it. They're making that difficult for you to bring somebody legal while the borders are wide open. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, and I think most people agree with this, I think most farmers agree with this as much as they need labor, until we get the border under control, it's going to be hard to do immigration reform. Mm-hmm. People understand Trump tried to do immigration reform. Trump actually was offered the Dreamers legal status. Mm-hmm. He offered a temporary protective service, TPS services programs to get to professional status or status in exchange for the wall. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats wouldn't take it. And I remember talking to a good friend of mine on the other side, and it was close to Speaker Pelosi. I said, so you guys aren't going to take Dreamers being legal? So anybody out there says, well, Republicans don't care about Dreamers. That's absolutely not true. Right. I said, you're not going to take legal Dreamers. These are the people who came here as kids, who came with their parents, get legal status with path to citizenship, and people with temporary protective service getting legal status to stay instead of every 3 years having to update, some other things in there. It wasn't everything they wanted, but things in there. And they said, you know, we don't want Trump to get credit for immigration reform. That's what that's the person said to me.
Yeah.
And they'd rather have the issue than solving it. So I've been to different meetings. I have town halls. People come, pro-immigration folks, and they rail on that. And I say, well, you know, President Trump, you know, Democratic Party turned down having legal status for people here with Dreamers. That's a fact. That's just, I know that. I was in some of the conversations on it. And so the farm labor is something we got to labor anywhere and everywhere in our economy is important.
Well, it's what makes our industry viable is having that access to labor. We see, I think my biggest concern with the H-2A program is it's getting more and more expensive for those people who can jump through the hoops, who have to because they have to have that labor. Has there been any thoughts or any movements to maybe restructure that program to get it more like the H-2B program? And a lot of folks don't even know that exists. But it seems to me like it's got just a lot more, I don't want to say loose, a lot freer for those people who work in and out of that system.
Well, one, so So on the H-2A, it shouldn't be as hard as it is. That's what I'm saying. The administration that's allowing people to freely come across the border is – and we can talk about what we need to do, I think, to fix it, what we're trying to do now on the border as we stand, trying to force the president to do. But people to legally come across the border, they're making it harder to do. It's their cost, and it's costly, and they have so much red tape to go through it to try to get somebody legally here to work. Though Congress has given a pathway for people to legally come here to work, and the Biden administration making it extremely difficult to do. So you can fix it. You can relax it, but it takes changing the law. And I will tell you, although I think most Republicans would agree we need to fix this, you're not going to get the other side to vote for that unless you can get – they want more things in immigration reform. And that's where that gets the sticking point. And it's hard to give anything on the other side and immigration reform without knowing those borders are going to be secure. So even if you give a legal pathway for people to stay here that have come here, you know, maybe years ago illegally, you know, I'm not for a path for citizenship, but there's a way for them to work. They've been here. Their kids are citizens because they're born here. you know, we need to look at that, but you just can't do it until we know that the law is going to be enforced as it is. And so what we're trying to do now, so the president's come and asked for over $100 billion in aid to Israel, which I think most Americans support aid to Israel. We can talk about aid to Ukraine. I think stopping Putin in Ukraine is important if you want to keep American men and women out of fighting in Europe. Keeping him bogged down in Ukraine or defeated in Ukraine is the best situation, is important to do, but not at the expense of our southern border. And so all we're asking the president is that before we do any foreign aid, we want to make sure we take care of our southern border and force him to do so. And what's going to happen, so people understand, is that, you know, we're going to, what we're trying to force and what will happen. So we want a specific thing, and I'll talk about it. But we'll have people on my side of the house says, well, I know that's in there, but we don't have E-Verify. We don't have all these other things, so I'm not going to vote for it. We're not building the wall like we want to build or whatever. The thing that would stop what you're seeing at the border right now, absolutely stop it to a trickle, in my opinion, because Trump didn't have zero illegal immigration coming across, but it was approaching that. And what he did was the Remain in Mexico policy. So what happens, you can get asylum coming to this country if you have a credible fear of persecution in your home country. That's the word. That's what the law essentially says. And so all these people are traveling through Mexico from all over the world, coming to Mexico, paying these cartels to bring them across. And they're not eluding for the most part, if they're eluding our Border Patrol, they're coming for other nefarious reasons, probably bringing drugs, fentanyl. That's killing people. It's coming across the border because we're not controlling it. But they come up, they go to a Border Patrol agent and just kind of throw their hands up and say, I have a credible fear of persecution in my home country. That automatically gives them temporary refugee status and right to go work until they get a court date. Right now it's some people are saying maybe now that this surge is coming up to 5 years to get a court date. So you get 5 years to come work in the United States by just saying those words. And then very few show back up for their court date. What President Trump did, once you made that claim, he said, okay, we got it. Here's your court date. Now you're going to go back and remain in Mexico, and you can't come to the United States until your court date. What that did would stop the travel. Because people would get word pretty quick that you can't come to the United States. Because some of these people are paying up to $10,000 to these cartels to come. Well, if you get to the border and have to stay in Mexico, you can't earn the money to pay it back. They're all coming to the United States and sending money back to these cartels. That's what's happening. So it just even if you believed in open borders, which I don't, but if you believed in it, the humanitarian issues to these people, they're essentially enslaved to these cartels, because if they don't send the money back, the cartels are going to go kill their family.
Right.
And cartels are killing each other's migrants to try to get, you know, back in the old day where if it was a drug trade, you're encroaching on my turf, so I'm going to kill all your people. If you're bringing migrants on another cartel's turf because you're trying to expand your turf, they kill the migrants. Because if the cartel spends the money to get the migrant to the border and then the other cartel kills the migrant, the migrant can't come across the border and send money back. And that's going on. That absolutely is going on. I've been down there. I've heard it. I didn't see it, but I heard it firsthand from our Border Patrol. And it's just a humanitarian nightmare. It's awful. So to fix the problems we know we need to fix in our immigration system is going to have to wait until we can get control of the border.
What's that doing to the you know, the border towns, the towns? You know, and I know – And I even want you to comment about what's happening in Kentucky. Are there being some, you know, are there some migrants coming to Kentucky? You know, how's that affecting everything?
There are. Now, there's a couple of ways that migrants come here. One is just pure refugees. Like we know, like they actually go through the system, do it correctly. I know Bowling Green has a refugee center. Owensboro has a refugee center. So you'll see people particularly, I think now a lot of them are coming from Burmese. We've had Bosnians. I mean, people have come and become wonderful citizens. I mean, a lot of our businesses, there are big trucking companies out of Bowling Green owned by Bosnian families who came with nothing in the 1990s. I can go to Cambodian family. I can show you businesses these people have created and added to the fiber of the country. So that's good.
Right.
But they were done legally. They came here with services, and they came here with family sponsors, and they came here with people moving forward. What's happening now, those border towns, I was in El Paso. The mayor of El Paso, I assume a liberal Democrat, is just beside herself with the situation moving forward. You've seen Eagle Pass. I mean, think of a town the size of Morgantown, where we're doing this record, and all of a sudden you're getting 4,000 migrants a day coming through your town.
Right.
Does that not change? You know, of the of New York City, which Metro New York is 20 million people, and the city of New York, 7 million people, are getting migrants, and they're overwhelmed with it. Yep. Imagine if you're a city of 10,000 people, right, and you're getting moving forward. So I think that was smart to for Governor DeSantis and Governor Abbott to send people to New York. And if you want to be sanctuaries, it's easy to be a sanctuary state and city until you have to become one. It's easy to say that, and all of a sudden you got to provide all of the services and what it does to the other citizens, what it drains from the other citizens of your. Like I said, if people come here legally, I mean, like I said, look at. I mean, I live in Bowling Green. I go to businesses owned by, you know, I had a kid one day. He said what his last name was, and he was a friend of my son's, and he said his last name. I won't say it, but it was very, had a lot more syllables than vowels. Right. And when he said it, I said, "Oh, you must be Bosnian." Mm-hmm. And he said, "My parents are."
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that, and that's what you want. That's exactly what you. And I want to say, I mean, go to. I could get you some really good donuts in Bowling Green from a owned by a Cambodian family. And I could. It's just, you go on and on. They really are entrepreneurs. They're business people, and they bring to the fabric of the community what they, their desire to come to America and be
are
hard
the
workers.
You want. Those are the people you want.
They do it legally and they do it in the right. And some of these people come across probably could be the same way, but they need to come in a legal way that we know who they are. They have services. They get plugged into a job, and we know that they earn their own keep. I mean, like I said, these people who've come into our town are earning their own keep. They're, matter of fact, one guy is a massive employer, massive employer.
I want to switch gears just a little bit here. First of all, I want to thank you for your service.
Thanks.
We do appreciate your service and those that are currently serving, those that have served. That I don't think they get thanked enough.
Thanks.
And we do appreciate that. And secondly, you mentioned agriculture, and somebody asked you, you know, what do you know about agriculture? And the thing is, in agriculture, We're all touched by agriculture in some way, form, or fashion. Some of us are farmers, some of us are not, but we are all touched by it. And so I think we all are involved in agriculture in some way. We just may not be in production. But talk just a little bit about the importance of the farmers, the ag community, the ag businesses, how important it is for you to hear from them. Mm-hmm. Because when you're asked... when you're having to go to these hearings and you're talking about the farm bill and all and the energy and all these things that you work with, how important is it for you to hear from the folks back at home, from particularly in agriculture, and how the best way for them to contact their representatives?
Well, that is extremely important because it's a complex business, as we all know. I've you know, been to farms in LaRue County, farms here in Butler County, and just the financing of the, when they start talking about how much they're spending on fertilizer coming forward, with the rising cost of fertilizer, the fossil fuels that they spend, the effect that it has moving forward. And I know a lot of farmers. I mean, there's several. I have my cell number. You can text me and say what's moving forward. I was with a good friend of mine here in Butler, in Warren, Butler County, named Shane Wells, down in Rochester, mm-hmm. where he farms, mm-hmm. and he was like on the phone to a financial person doing hedging, you know, mm-hmm. hedging, and so yeah. to be a farmer, not only do you have to know soil, you have to know finance, you got to know all these other things, and so I don't think those of us who do that realize how you can't just be specialized in one thing. If you're running a major ag business, you really mm-hmm. have a lot moving forward. But things like that, like the price of fertilizer, if you have a war in Ukraine, that caused some of the problems. Mm-hmm. Potash. I was in a NATO meeting and somebody kept talking about potash. That's what they kept saying. So finally, I said, I don't know what potash is, but it sounds important. Then finally, it dawned on me she was saying potash, and yeah. which comes out of Belarus, which is
yep, right.
you know is part of what's going on in the war. So what mm-hmm. happens in the world is important to what happens to agriculture. Mm-hmm. And I tell people this is what it's hard to describe trade and agriculture. Because you can, and here we are in Morgantown. I can tell you, I was in the state Senate when NAFTA passed. Mm-hmm. And I can take you about a quarter mile from where we're sitting right now and show you a building that used to be Sumitomo. Now they got businesses in there, so it's working, but it's not one employer with 700 people working, you know, good wages jobs. It's a lot of employers working good wage jobs, not that one single big employer. But that closed down right after NAFTA. So it's easy to point to those buildings. And I tell people, we got to drive past the field, look at every third ear of corn or every third soybean bush, and that's going overseas somewhere. So when President Trump got in some trade wars with Europe and with China, it really affected farmers in a negative way. And people said, why does all this affect farmers? I said, well, go back to high school economics. What do you trade? You trade what you're the best at. Because if you're not the best at it, you're going to be inefficient. You're most efficient. You can take care of your market and have surplus to trade. And that's farmers. It shows what farmers are, the most efficient, the best in the world at it. And so when you start looking at all of these issues, there's so much stuff that affects farming. It's not just, you know, and remember when they were trying to say there's too much dust behind a tractor? Farmers are going to have to keep dust from coming behind their tractors. EPA, that came. I mean, that's just silly, but it was part of the Obama EPA, if you remember.
And so
there's a lot of ag groups. I hear from the soybeans, corn grower. If I start naming them, I'm into Farm Bureau always has an annual trip to D.C. and are really good about reaching out and talking. All of the trade associations to be members of that, I think it's important to be a trade association. Now, if you get a letter from somebody in the mail saying, I'm something political action pack, send me $50 and I'll tell Brett Guthrie that your farm issues or whatever, your issues are important to you, don't do that. Absolutely don't do that. I've never had any body that sends you a letter to say, send us money and we'll talk to your congressman for you, has ever talked to me, ever. But I can tell you, the Soybean Association, Corn Growers Association, Cattlemen's, Hog Farmers, they all have groups. Pork producers, they all have a group, and they're all effective, and they talk about how this affects their energy. I think that's a good way to be involved in that. But we have field reps that are out in the community. Most people will know in the ag community, chambers of commerce. And a lot of them, believe me, I hear from them on my cell phone. So
we tell our farmers all the time, they're really good at farming. I mean, they're really good at farming. They're really good at doing their job. They're not as comfortable when they're not farming, but they're talking to people about issues and concerns that they have, because that's just that's not the part of the job that they like. But it's an important part. It's really important for them to tell their story. It's really important for them to be involved in these organizations that are their voice for you all as you all are making decisions. And it's extremely important.
And the opinion of farmers are weighted heavy for me. And I'll tell you why, because not many people go out and buy a farm out of nowhere and just start farming tomorrow. They've got it generationally. Okay. So they're tied to the land. It's where their parents are from. It's where their grandparents are from. Sometimes great grandparents are from. So they're tied to the land and they love their community. Shane Wells is a great example. I always joke with him because he got red faced with me one time about the Rochester school. And I had nothing to do with it shutting down, if Shane listens to this. But he's a good redhead, so he got going at me one time. But only say that because he absolutely loves where he's from. Yep. And almost every farmer is a deacon in their church. They're on the board of the water board, the sewer board, some kind of board, a fire department. Yep. So they know their communities. And our districts are a collection of communities. You know, some are big like Bowling Green. Yep. Some are small like Rochester. But we're all a collection of communities. And so we get to hear if I keep picking on Shane. If he calls me about something in Rochester, I know that's what people in Rochester are thinking. Yep. And not just him, usually. Right. And so that it's important to hear that, because we know they're speaking for a place that they love. It's in their heart. They always say dirt's in your shoes, but it's also in your heart. Mm-hmm. And that's why talking to members of people in agriculture is important.
Well, we appreciate that, Congressman Guthrie. And I know our time is winding down, but on behalf of everybody, thank you for what you do for agriculture.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate really the opportunity to serve and to be engaged in the Farm Bill. Believe me, we're not on the committee, so we aren't engaged in it. We talk to farm groups every day, and we're G.T. Thompson, who so put him in your prayers. He just got diagnosed with prostate cancer. I know a lot of people his age are diagnosed with it and live a long life with it, and take care of it. Sometimes it doesn't go that way. So put him in your prayers. But he's probably 64, 65. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a good man, and he's working hard to try to get this done together. And it's important for the input.
Yep. Absolutely. You know, well, one of the things we always do at the end of this show, we like to wrap things up with a timely tip. Sometimes it's, you know, pertinent to the information that we just talked about. Sometimes it's pertinent to the time of the year that it is. We thought a good timely tip for today. David and I both discussed this ahead of time because to know more about you and to prepare for this show, we both went to your website. We looked up information, read a little bit about your background and some of the programs that you're working on. We thought a good timely tip for today would just be encourage all of our listeners to get involved. If you don't know a lot about your elected officials, go to that website. That's where you can find out the history of the votes and what the different committees that they've worked on, what their voting record is. We all want folks involved in the process, and we want folks to be educated about the process.
Exactly.
We felt like that was a good place to start.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, we, as David said, we appreciate you being here with us today. We want to thank Congressman Guthrie for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.
Thank you.